It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There is new scientific evidence that suggests the coronavirus can stay aloft in the form of these teeny tiny droplets in stagnant air. A group of hundreds of international experts signed an open letter this week to the WHO, the World Health Organization, asking for more guidance in explaining how the virus can transmit in the air. The WHO responded yesterday saying the evidence needs to be gathered and interpreted. What do you think needs to be done to slow the spread of the virus? What are your concerns about aerosols, droplets, and stagnant air? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics and a faculty member at the UW School of Medicine Division of Infectious Disease. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
We're seeing a spike in cases here in Wisconsin. It's happening around the country. What is going on?
Well, I think what we're seeing is how a pandemic typically behaves. Because the entire population is vulnerable, it is expected that any time human behavior changes, cases will rise in response to that.
How have we seen human behavior change in recent weeks?
Well, I think early on in the pandemic with the safer at home order, we noticed that physical mobility went way down, and with that, so did the cases. It remained suppressed until the time that people started moving around more and getting together in gatherings and so forth. And I think that's contributed to the increase that we're seeing.
In our state, despite the increases in cases, the number of reported deaths per week is slowing down. Why is that happening?
Well, I think there might be a couple of explanations. One is that the increase in cases are now occurring, or at least some of them are occurring in a younger demographic, and those are typically individuals who don't have some of the higher risk conditions that might lead to an increased risk of complications. And the other is that deaths is a lagging indicator and sometimes may take weeks before you would see that number go up.
So when you look at that younger demographic and the infection, what do you see in that population, you know, age 20 to 29 or so?
I think what we're seeing is that they typically will have milder symptoms. They will fortunately recover, or most will. Of course, it's not an entirely homogenous demographic. Even within the 20 to 30, there are several people who will get complications and will not have the expected good outcome. So I think we still have to be very careful, but that does seem to be the case, that they do relatively better.
And how do we gauge outcomes? When is someone rid of the virus or completely recovered?
There's a huge variation in recovery, and in part it depends upon the severity of the symptoms and the complications that may follow from the symptoms. In hospitalized patients, we're finding that there is a prolonged length of stay, and even after people recover, they still might take a long time before they would go fully back to where they felt before. In people who have mild symptoms, they may recover within a week to 2 weeks, although the physical presence of the virus may still take longer to completely disappear.
There's evidence that scientists are looking at a new strain of the virus. What are you seeing there?
They're trying to understand whether this explains some of the changes that we're seeing in the demographic of the population that is experiencing symptoms, in that the new strain appears to be easier to spread, but doesn't cause as severe an illness. And it does seem to be fairly compelling evidence in the paper that was recently published describing it.
And so a strain that would be circulating in New York City, for example, would be different than what is circulating in Wisconsin communities. How does that work?
There are similarities, but there are also some differences. And in part, it depends upon where that strain was introduced into the U.S. from. And because there are multiple points of introduction, it's conceivable that some strains might have come from other parts of the world where the pandemic appeared sooner than it did in the U.S.
So as you see the spike here in Wisconsin and reverberating around the country, is it because we are reopening too soon? What is causing, is it a uniform cause around the country that you're seeing these numbers going way up?
I think each state is showing its own trajectory. And in part, yes, I think it is dependent upon, we have found it's very sensitive to human behavior. And so when we open up businesses and things, even though it's, of course, necessary to some extent, we have to be very careful in that we don't want to do it too fast, too soon, and then be prepared to roll it back if circumstances demand it.
We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's explaining the recent uptick in COVID-19 cases, what people should be doing to help stop the spread. You can join in with your questions. What do you think about the spike? How do you go about helping control the spread? How have you been changing your lifestyle as you watch the numbers? We're at 800-642-1234. We heard from Matt in Wausau, emailed us this morning, Dr. Safdar. Matt wants to see a statewide mandate for wearing masks. How much could that step help reduce cases?
You know, I think with a pandemic like this, where we don't have reliable therapeutics and there's no vaccine yet, we have to have a great deal of adherence to all the interventions that could potentially help. And masking is one of those suite of solutions, as is physical distancing. And so I think that, yes, we should all be masking anytime that the situation calls for it.
You've been looking at the number of people wearing masks, such as in and out of the grocery stores. What do you see there in those numbers?
We found that about half the people that were exiting grocery stores were not wearing masks. Women were more likely to wear masks than men, and older adults were more likely to be wearing masks than younger people.
Do you think that if communities start to make mask wearing mandatory, that those numbers would change? Or do you see that people are just really firm in whether they're going to wear a mask or not?
You know, I shouldn't think so. I would think that if there was an order, which there is now in Dane County, for mandatory masking, that behavior would change in response to that.
You know, earlier in our program, we were talking about shopping habits, and one listener tweeted about only shopping online because they refused to wear masks in stores. They called masks useless and nonsense. What is your response to that?
I think that, you know, we should confine ourselves, I think, to essential activities in person. And so when we do engage in those, and that might mean going to grocery stores, for instance, then we do have to wear a mask. Other types of shopping, I think, yes, it's probably preferable to not be in person. But if you do have to be in person, then wearing a mask is better than not wearing a mask.
Can you explain what a mask really does for us?
So a mask serves two purposes. It protects the wearer and it protects other individuals around them. And between two people, if one is wearing a mask, that's good. But if both are wearing a mask, that's even better.
And protecting them from droplets, protecting from sneezes, what is actually the protection against?
So it's protecting them from droplets. If the individual has symptoms, then yes, it will contain the large aerosolization of and the emission of secretions that happen when somebody has a respiratory illness.
You talked about aerosol there, and scientists are really wanting to get information out of the WHO about whether these aerosol droplets are transmitting the coronavirus. What are you wanting to learn about droplets?
I think we, you know, really want to have a great grip on our understanding of how COVID-19 and the virus that causes it is transmitted. And the reason why that's so important is because it drives what PPE is recommended and is used. I think that when the WHO evaluates its evidence, we're curious about whether it will change its recommendations or not. We traditionally in infection control do not think of SARS-CoV-2 as an classically airborne transmitted viruses, which we define as a virus that can travel large distances, sort of wafting along on air. By its definition, every respiratory illness is going to be transmitted via the air in some form or the other. But the droplet means that these are larger droplets that fall to the ground versus very small particles that keep floating and remain transmissible.
Are there any new discoveries into asymptomatic people and what the connection may be to aerosolization of the virus?
So asymptomatic transmission does appear to be important for COVID-19 transmission. While the exact numbers are not known, it is estimated that up to a quarter of infections may be transmitted that way. One of the things that complicates is that it's not clear whether it's entirely asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, meaning that they just hadn't developed symptoms at the time the test is done, or they have very mild symptoms that they may not even be aware of at the time, such as a loss of sense of smell and taste. But having said that, yes, asymptomatic transmission is important here.
How long might a person be pre-symptomatic?
Usually from say somebody is asymptomatic, they get a test. Within that 10-week period following that is when they would typically develop symptoms if they were going to develop them.
When you look at the trend lines right now, are we considered to be in a second wave? Is it still too soon to tell? What do you look at when you're watching these numbers come out each day and the trends?
I think it's hard to say exactly because it's not behaving as you would expect a seasonal respiratory virus to behave. Normally, you'd expect, you know, there'd be a wave in the fall, then a lull in the summer, and a second wave in the fall. Here, we're seeing these high peaks at various points for, you know, differing between states. So I don't know that I can call it a second wave. It seems to be this smoldering in some areas and greatly increasing in others.
Well, yeah, and you know, temperatures are very high here in the summer. I mean, we've had a string of 90-degree days and still a spike. So, you know, weather doesn't seem to be factoring into this, does it?
It doesn't appear to be, no.
So as you look at the hospital situation, are your hospital in clinics keeping up with the demand from testing and inpatient care?
You know, so far, hospital capacity, I think, has been doing well. But of course, the concern is that as the number of cases grow, will it happen after a few weeks that there will be individuals who get infected who will need hospital care and then will need to come in for that? So we want to be prepared for that if that happens.
Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's giving us an update on the recent surge in COVID-19 cases and what the medical community is doing and thinking about with the spread. Have you been tested? Do you think you were exposed at a gathering of people? What do you want to know about safety precautions as you head into work? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Safdar here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the surge of COVID-19 cases around the country and here in Wisconsin. Scientists are raising concerns with the WHO about crowded indoor spaces with poor ventilation that may help explain the spread in meatpacking plants, churches, restaurants. Are you wearing a mask when you go out? Do you frequent restaurants, bars, coffee shops? Are you sticking close to home? How do you manage risk at this point in the pandemic? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Let's take a call now. Jenny is with us from Viroqua. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Now that dental offices have reopened, I'm wondering what your guest thoughts are on the safety of dental visits.
I think that dental offices, just like most other institutions, have taken a lot of steps to ensure that that their patients are safe when they come in. And that it might include things like not having people wait in waiting rooms, making sure that they're masked when they go in. So if it's essential dental work that you need, I would think that now would be a safe time to do so.
Jenny, I just had a filling last week before, and I was just astounded by the safety measures, not getting out of my car, texting when I'm there, and they come out or say when I can come in, holding the door open, I don't touch anything, escorting me right to my chair. I was astounded by the amount of PPE. And at the end of the visit, I was escorted out a back door, not even going in the door I came in. Dr. Safdar, what are some of these measures, and do you think that they are appropriate?
I think they're very appropriate for the type of transmission we know can happen with SARS-CoV-2. The whole idea is to promote physical distancing as much as possible. I mean, we know we have the 6 feet rule, and the reason that comes about is because that's the distance a large droplet would typically travel before it drops to the ground. So anything we can do to minimize people coming into contact with each other is a good idea to prevent transmission.
I also had to swish with hydrogen peroxide, and it was gross. It was awful. What is that doing?
It's an antiseptic for the mouth, as are many others. So not sure that by itself is doing much for this particular virus, but as an antiseptic following dental work, it's commonly used.
Jenny, thanks for the call. Let's go to Stephanie now in Milwaukee. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a nurse that has so far avoided contracting the virus, and I'm scrupulous of wearing a mask everywhere I go. I know that the Czech Republic has managed to clear things because everyone wore the mask. I don't understand why we just can't mandate it and clear it up in a few weeks.
Stephanie, thank you for the call and for the work you're doing right now. Dr. Safdar, have you looked at other countries and how they have approached mask wearing?
I think that, you know, in the U.S., we historically have not had a culture of mask use, unlike many other countries, particularly in Asia, that have been wearing masks for much longer than we have. And any time that behavior is new, it will take time and dedicated discipline and energy to instill it. I do think that it is time for us to be very vigilant about wearing masks everywhere we go. And whatever measures will influence our behavior are important to take, which might require mandating it.
Stephanie, may I ask how you are doing as you work in a really stressful environment in nursing right now and trying to stay safe and stay free of the virus?
Well, I am full of optimism, and I know that we are very careful, that we're very good. I see what is going on to try and prevent the spread within the hospital. And it just, I actually talk to people when I'm outside and see them wearing a mask and say, thank you for respecting me. I respect you by wearing the mask. And I'm hopeful. I'm there to help somebody, and my life is worth helping one other person.
Oh, Stephanie, thank you for that. We also heard from Dick in Middleton, called in, couldn't stay with us, Dr. Safdar. And Dick wants to know, how much impact have the protests had on spreading the coronavirus?
It doesn't appear that the protests have led to a large spike in cases. It's sometimes not possible to tell entirely if that's the case or not, but it certainly doesn't seem to be.
In terms of businesses reopening, parties, gyms, churches, restaurants, bars, can we isolate anything there or extrapolate with the current surge?
I think that there are certain activities and certain places where it's very difficult to do the two measures that we know will work to interrupt transmission, physical distancing and masking. And a place, for example, is a restaurant or a bar. You're shoulder to shoulder, the music is loud, you can't hear each other, you're tempted to pull down your mask so that people can, so that you can talk easily, and you're eating and drinking, so you can't effectively mask anyway. So that's sort of the perfect storm of why these areas might precipitate a cluster.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics, taking your questions about the virus, 800-642-1234. Dr. Safdar, as you've been watching the treatment protocols come out here on COVID-19, have any changes been made with how patients are being treated in the hospital right now?
Yes, so I think we have a couple of options now for treatment. One is convalescent plasma, which is plasma taken from people who have recovered from COVID-19. Another is a medication called remdesivir that is still in trials but has shown promise in reducing length of stay. And the third is steroids, which also appear promising. These are for hospitalized people with fairly severe illness. We're still seeking therapeutic options for those with mild symptoms that might benefit from something.
How early on do you give these type of treatments? Do you give this intervention?
You try to give them early on in the hospitalization because you want people to not get to the stage where they will require mechanical ventilation or need ICU care, if possible.
When you look at the tests coming back and the shape that the lungs are in, are you seeing any changes that way in how the virus is affecting the lungs?
I think that it takes a pretty profound toll on lung health, and the impact of that it has really depends upon how well your lungs were doing before you got sick with COVID-19. So in people who already have pre-existing lung disease or are smokers or have vaped or have otherwise, you know, had lung damage from any reason, they would have a much harder time recovering from it than others would.
Many schools are trying to figure out how to prepare to bring kids back in the fall. What do we know about COVID-19 in children?
Children, particularly younger children, tend to get mild symptoms and don't appear to be a population of high risk for COVID-19. They can, however, get post-infectious syndromes, which are not a direct effect of the virus, but nonetheless, the body's response is severe enough that they need hospitalization and might even need ICU care. Older children, high schoolers and above, will tend to behave very much like young adults in the way that they contract and spread the illness. So, and it's a setting where people are together in large numbers, so it's a high-risk situation.
We have time for one more call. Steve in Antioch. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I had a question. You were talking about the droplets falling, you know, within 6 feet of a person. Should we be disinfecting our shoes because we will be stepping on these droplets?
I think shoes in general are to be considered contaminated in all settings. Whether one disinfects or not, I don't think it's a bad idea necessarily to disinfect them. I can tell you from the healthcare worker viewpoint, we do encourage that people leave their shoes outside the house when they come back in after work, and that the pair of shoes that they use should be designated for work activity and not, you know, wearing it around the house.
Well, I can take one look at my kids' shoes and they're contaminated, that's for sure. That's all I know. Dr. Safdar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. Just ahead, we talk to the author of a new book about Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, about the never-before-seen documents he used to write the biography. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.